Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and also our radio and online audiences. And I'm very pleased to have Don George here to speak about his book, Wanderlust. It's a great name. I mean, obviously, people have been talking about Wanderlust for a long time. Many have been afflicted with it at different parts of their life. Some people do it when they're young. Some people do it when they're in their 60s. Some people do it both times. Some people leave their jobs when they're 40 and go on and do it, but Don George has made an entire life of doing this. And so he's going to tell us, for those of you who haven't engaged or indulged in your wanderlust, you'll do it all vicariously. And for those of you who've done it occasionally, you'll see what a pro is like. Don.
Thank you, George. Thank you very much. Yes, my middle name is actually Warner, but I've decided to tell people that my middle name is Wanderlust from now on because it seems to work. Thank you also very much for coming tonight. It's a beautiful day in San Francisco, and you could be at the beach, and instead you're here, so I really, really appreciate it. Thanks for coming. What I thought I would do tonight is talk a little bit about just my life as a travel writer. I've been lucky enough to make this my living. As George said, I've been tending to my wanderlust all my professional life. I thought I might read just a few very short stories from my book, The Way of Wanderlust, The Best Travel Writing of Don George, and just to give you a little tiny taste of the book itself. And then I just thought I'd open the floor to questions because I love hearing what you want to ask, finding out why you've come, what it is you're looking for in the way of information or anecdotes. And so I always find that the interaction with the audience is the highlight of an event like this for me. So I hope to leave a lot of time for questions and answers. So I really was lucky to stumble into the field of travel writing. I originally wanted to be a poet when I was an undergraduate, and we all know what a great living poets make. Seemed like a really practical career path to me. So I went to Princeton back in New Jersey, and I studied comparative literature and creative writing. And during my senior year, when all my friends were getting ready to go to graduate school or medical school or business school or pre-med, to medical school, I just knew I didn't want to do any of that. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but I knew I didn't want to do that. And I found out about a fellowship that was called the Athens College Teaching Fellowship at Athens College in Greece. And I applied for it, and four graduating seniors were selected, and somehow I was one of the four selected. And before I went to Greece, I also knew about a Princeton program called the Princeton Summer Work Abroad program that the French department ran. And I actually had been living in Paris the summer before on that program, and I decided to go to Paris again. So I lived in Paris for the summer on that program, and then I went to Athens, Greece for a year. And that year really changed my life. I went over to Europe thinking I would sort of take a year off and dabble in post-college life, maybe a little bohemian life in Paris and Athens, and then sort of get back on track again and go to graduate school and probably become a Tweedy professor of comparative literature somewhere. And then there was a moment in Paris that really planted the seed. I remember it was probably the second or third week of my 3 month stay in Paris, and I was living on the Rue de Rivoli, right across from the Tuileries Gardens. And I went down, I had a job, I was working at Kodak Pâté. And I went down to the street, stepped out of the rickety old filigreed elevator that I took down every morning and walked out into the big imposing doors that led onto the street. And I was walking down the Rue de Rivoli and I just stopped. And I just had this feeling. Time seemed to stop, and I looked around me, and I realized that France was all around me. People were speaking French, wearing French, paying for things with francs, going into the shops and saying, "Bonjour, Monsieur Dame," and drinking their cafe creme, standing up elbow to elbow. And it was just this big panorama of France all around me. And I stopped and thought, the real reason why I like to study other countries' literature, the reason why I love to study French literature, is to learn about France and French culture. And here I am standing in Paris, and I thought I was going to go back to the classroom in the United States and study and study. And then I thought, no, that's wrong. This is the classroom. This right here, this street in Paris, this is my classroom. This is where I want to study. And I think that seed really changed my life. I went on to go to Athens, traveled all around in Athens and around. I went to Egypt, I went to Italy, had lots of adventures during that year abroad, came back to the United States, and had a moment, actually, before coming back to the United States, I had a moment in Athens when I had applied to both graduate schools in comparative literature and graduate schools in creative writing. And there was a sleepless night in Athens, a truly sleepless night in Athens, when, as the dawn rose over the Attic plain, I sort of looked into my heart and said, I'm going to study creative writing. I've got to follow that path. That's what something is calling me to do. It's safer. I sort of understand the route of becoming a professor. I understand that route. I don't understand the route of becoming a writer, but that's what my heart is telling me I want to do. So I'm going to do that. And I took kind of a great leap of faith then. I went to graduate school in creative writing, got a master's degree, wrote a book of poetry, which sits at the bottom of the bottom of the bottom of a dresser drawer in my bedroom, called Finding a Place. And then, again, as graduation approached, didn't quite know what to do with my life and knew that Princeton had these wonderful fellowships called Princeton in Asia Fellowships that were for 2 years and that allowed the winners to live in Asia, usually teaching, although there were different kinds of fellowships. And I applied for that fellowship. And part of the requirements at that time to win the fellowship, they tried to select people who had not studied East Asian studies and were not Asia experts. I thought it was kind of enlightened in that way, that they really wanted to introduce people to Asia who hadn't already had a familiarity with it. So I like to say that I was the most ignorant applicant of all, and so I won the fellowship. So my absolute ignorance about anything Asian got me the fellowship, and I went to Japan for 2 years, and I lived in Tokyo, and I taught at a school called International Christian University for 2 years, and that really, really changed my life. I began to write my first travel articles when I was there. I met the woman who would become my wife when I was there, and this country that I knew almost literally nothing about before I arrived suddenly became intricately interwoven into my wife and into my life. And so that changed my life tremendously. After 2 years, I ended up leaving Japan and coming back to the United States and ended up settling in San Francisco. And through a long and serendipitous series of improbable things, after about 2 months here, I ended up meeting someone who knew the then travel editor at the San Francisco Examiner. The Examiner was the paper that published the travel section back in those days. This was a legendary woman named Georgia Hess. Do any of you remember, you know Georgia Hess? A really fantastic writer, editor, person, a really amazing person. I met someone who knew Georgia. Georgia was getting ready to take a leave of absence from her job. She called up this woman who I had met and said, I'm getting ready to take a leave of absence. I'm wondering if you might be interested in taking my job for me while I'm gone. And she said, no, I can't. I'm too busy. But I just met this nice young man who moved to the Bay Area, and he might be perfect for your job. And literally, unbeknownst to me, I didn't know they'd had that conversation. Literally 20 minutes after they had that conversation, I called up the Examiner travel section to inquire about the status of a story I'd written about Japan. And Georgia Hess answered the phone, and I kind of fainted when she answered the phone and said, hello, this is Georgia Hess. I didn't expect to speak to the legend. I thought I would get some, you know, minor person. And I said, Ms. Hess, you don't know me. My name is Don George, but I sent you an article about Kyushu in Japan, and I'm just wondering what the status of the article is. And she said, I don't know anything about your article, but I'd very much like to meet you. I've just been talking with someone about you. And so I fainted, picked myself back up, and ended up meeting her. And one thing led to another. I got interviewed by the publisher and the editor, managing editor of the paper, and actually got hired to take her place for her leave of absence. So that just turned my life upside down in the best possible way. I started working at the Examiner. I was there for a year, and then Georgia decided not to come back. They ended up replacing her actually with somebody else who had a lot more experience than I did. But that was the beginning. From that point on, I made my living as a travel writer. And so that really, she changed my life. That experience changed my life. And I can look back on the progression of my life and kind of see the improbable stepping stones that led one to another, to another, to another, that led to that job, that led to me being here today. I ended up, for a short period of time, being the travel editor at the San Jose Mercury News, and then the Examiner Sunday Magazine had an editor resign, and they asked me if I would come and take that position, and I did. And then a few years later, in 1986, I was named the travel editor at the Examiner. So I was the Examiner travel editor from 86 to 95, and I count those among the very happiest, most wonderful years of my life. It was a great honor. I moved on from there to work for a fledgling publication called Salon.com, an online site that was just getting started, kind of rewriting all the rules of publishing online. And I did that for about 7 years. And then I went to work for Lonely Planet Publications. Does anybody know Lonely Planet? Yeah. So I was the global travel editor at Lonely Planet for about 7 years. And then in 2007, I decided to go freelance, and I got quickly got a phone call from the editor at National Geographic Traveler, who asked me if I would become an editor at large there. And that's one of the things I do now. I'm an editor at large for Traveler, National Geographic Traveler. I'm also a special features editor for the BBC Travel website. I edit the blog and website for the great San Francisco adventure travel company Geographic Expeditions, which is based in the Presidio. Does anybody know them? They're wonderful. They do very adventurous, wonderful tours in most parts of the world. And I'm a freelance writer as well. So that's my life today. And pretty much all I've ever done in my life is write and edit travel stories. And I feel incredibly blessed that that's the case, because I love travel and I love writing. So somehow the universe has rewarded me. I must have done something very good in a former life. It's been very kind to me in this life. A few years ago, I began to think that I really should try to put together the best of Don George. And it felt sort of hubristic to even think that, but I had 700, 800 articles. I figured there must be a dozen that were pretty good out of that, and it might be fun to collect them in a book. And I talked about this idea with a great friend, long, long time San Francisco friend, who is here tonight, way in the back of the room, Larry Habiger, who's a wonderful man, who's the editor of a local publishing company called Traveler's Tales. And Traveler's Tales publishes great books of travel writing, anthologies of great travel stories and single author books. And they've been doing it for 20 years now, 25 years. And I revere them and their work. And I was incredibly honored and thrilled when Larry suggested that Traveler's Tales could publish this anthology of my work. So that was great. And then I kind of thought, well, let's do that. But then I didn't know how to go about doing it. And I had a daily schedule I had to keep track of, and I had commitments. And I ended up meeting a wonderful person named Candace Reardon, who sort of took this project over and ended up helping me very much to organize the stories and figure out what should go into the book, and became an integral, sort of interwoven part of the book as well. She's a super talented illustrator. She did the illustration for the book, the cover of the book, which I absolutely love. It kind of captures the story of my life. So with her help, I put together from the 700 articles, 35 stories that represent the best of me. They span 38 years of publishing, 24 countries. And I like to think that they encompass my philosophy of travel, my sense of wonder about the world, my sense that travel is probably the most important thing we can do. And in a way, the way travel is really a religion for me. I believe so firmly, so fervently in travel that what we do when we get out there is we create these connections, and the connections create more connections. And if we're ever going to have peace in the world and understanding, this is the way it's going to happen. On a grassroots basis, person by person by person, going out in the world, meeting people who are unfamiliar and having them be familiar. And that familiarity is going to build these bridges of understanding and these pathways of connection, and that will transform the world. And that's what I believe very strongly. And this book is kind of a manifestation of that. So I'll just read a couple of stories from the book, and then we'll open the floor up to questions. Do you all like love? I'll begin with a story about love. Excuse me. This is called In Love in Greece in the Springtime. It happens at some point every spring. I will be driving innocently along some rural route, and suddenly a certain slant of sunlight will recall the way the light filtered through the pine trees along the road that wound up the coast from Athens to the little taverna no one seemed to know about. No one except Gisela, the beautiful and mysterious woman with whom I had fallen ineluctably in love that spring of 1976. We would install ourselves in peeling white wooden chairs around a stolid wooden table on the beach under the pines, and the kindly taverna owner would bring us huge chunks of hard, delicious bread, a salad of feta cheese, tomatoes, cucumbers, and black olives, and glasses of Retsina. We would eat and sip, but mostly we would watch the shimmering sea and listen to the sighing pines, sensing the air with their tangy perfume. I recreate this scene, and suddenly that whole mind-opening, life-transforming Grecian year revives in a sun-flooded succession of images. I recall the breath-stopping, time-skipping beauty of just-blossomed scarlet poppies against white marble ruins at Olympia. I recall the Peloponnese mountain family who insisted on sharing their meager, eager Easter feast with my parents and me. I recall the ethereal geometry and bony patina of the Acropolis at dawn before the tourists arrived, and the soul-stirring rite of reading Plato, Socrates, and Aristotle as Apollo's first rays illumined the site. I recall unfathomable connections on the island of Crete, the magical frescoes and seer splendors of Knossos, and the painter from Chania who showed me the island's harbors and meadows, churches and town squares through his eyes. I recall the craggy monasteries and worldly monks of sacred Mount Athos, and the sensual abandon of the long, embracing beach at Lindos on Rhodes, where I communed for a week with a ragtag band of European pilgrims who were all seeking some sort of Aegean answer. Aegean answers. Hungrily, hesitantly, I would unfold for Gisela my despairs and my dreams. But mostly I would talk about Greece, about the clarity of the rock and the light and how it was teaching me to attend to the present, about the earthy kindness I had encountered everywhere, about the sheer age of the sights and the accumulation of wisdom and sadness and celebration that seemed to hang poignant in the attic air. Summer came and I left for Africa and then graduate school, a long, winding road. I never wrote to her, never heard from her. Now, half of my life later, I wonder, do we craft our memories or do our memories craft us? Now, half of my life later, I know. I went to Greece seeking the roots of Western civilization and returned with a rootlessness I have never lost. And every spring the owner shuffles toward us, bearing a laden tray. The sea shimmers, the pines sense and sigh. The attic sunlight gleams again in Gisela's laughing eyes. Thanks. So that's a little trip to Greece. I thought I'd read a piece about Uluru in Australia. Has anybody been to Ayers Rock, Uluru? Okay, it had a great effect on me. So I thought I would read this. Impression, sunrise at Uluru. The first time you approach Uluru, the world is still dark. You are rolling through the pre-dawn desert in a minivan when the big black monolith looms suddenly through the side window. It is difficult to judge how far away it is, or how close you are, because the whole world is monotone and flat. Yet you feel the power. You have been wary of your preconceptions about the place, the accumulation of iconography and cliches, photographs seen and descriptions read. You don't want to feel exactly what you know you are supposed to feel. You want a raw connection with the thing. You want to wipe your brain clean, approach the rock like the first human ever to take it in, stumbling incredulously toward it like some red sun trick on the horizon that doesn't disappear, but only grows larger and larger until finally all you can do is fall on your knees before it. And then you see it, and suddenly your wariness falls away. You are drawn to the dark immensity purely, simply, irresistibly, and with a power that comes from the thing itself and not, as far as you can tell, from your own desire to feel the power. Because it catches you by surprise and because it is such a strong pit of the stomach pull, you trust it. As you get closer, you creak and crane your neck to see as much of it as you can until you notice, because you'd been so obsessed with seeing the rock you'd miss this, that you are passing other minivans and buses and dozens upon dozens of people. They wear jeans and warm jackets and hold steaming cups of coffee in their hands. Some stamp their feet, others set up their cameras. They have come to see exactly what you have come to see. And you realize there is no point in trying to feel better than them or different from them. You have to share Uluru with them. Your minivan parks and you emerge, brushing off the cobwebs of some conversation about kangaroos and dingoes. All you want to do is concentrate on the rock itself, Uluru. You position yourself at one of the barriers beyond which visitors are not allowed to step, less than a kilometer from the rock, and you look. The rock is a smooth, sloping, burnt orange rise against a deep gray-blue sky. Before it are dark waves of vegetation, which surprise you. Somehow you imagine the rock standing solitary in a vast flatland, extending red and cracked dry to the horizon. For the next half hour, as the earth slowly tilts toward the sun at your back, you watch. The rock gradually grows more orange, more bright, and you begin to see the fissures and pocks in its side, shadowy sluices where rainfall must flow, deep gouges sculpted by wind and water and time. The sky lightens from dark blue to a pastel peach pink. The bushes and trees in the foreground take a silver green shape. The rock's orange brightens and pocks darken like caves in its side. The sky grows lighter and lighter, the rock face brighter and brighter. More veins and pits emerge in relief. And then, in what seems one miraculous moment, birdsong bursts from the bushes and trees, and the sun fires up the face of Uluru, and it is as if the rock is glowing from within, pulsing, breathing, one huge burning ember. And then it is like nothing you've seen before, and you simply don't have the words to describe it. It is alive with some kind of earth energy of its own. It pulses. It gathers everything into itself. It beats with a luminous orange energy that courses through the world around it. It is the heart of the soil and the rocks and the roots beneath the soil coming to life. You think of the elaborate sun temples that ancient civilizations constructed. Stonehenge, Teotihuacan, Machu Picchu, Sunian. And for a moment you think that this could be nature's sun temple, a construct manifesting a connection so far beyond comprehension that the only possible response is awe. And then the moment ends. The people pack up their cameras and pile into their buses. Within minutes, they are gone. But you remain, listening to the bird song, looking at the rock. You've had enough mysticism for one morning, so you drop to your knees and pick up a handful of soil. You want to ground yourself. But as you let the soil sift through your hands, slowly, softly, you feel it. Some kind of electrical connection. The particles passing through your fingers are the same as the particles that molded to form the rock. And you consider, are those particles really so different from the particles that molded into the big blue and green rock on which you now kneel? Sift, sift. The grains tilt through your dusty hands, bursting into sunlit life. Thanks. Thank you very much. I'll read one more. I want to take you to Japan, my second home. This story was part of a special magazine I actually published when I was at the Examiner about sacred places. So the beginning of the essay talks about sacred places. And then I get into this place, Ryoanji, the rock garden in Kyoto, Japan. It's called Ryoanji Reflections. When I think of the sacred places I have encountered in my own travels, I recall the Temple of Poseidon on the cliff of Cape Sunion in Greece, where I spent a wild night huddled in my sleeping bag among the moonlit columns, surrounded by tearing wind, the crashing of waves, and ghostly, godly dreams. I think, too, of Bali, of the lush, lovingly sculpted land and the gentle people, more profoundly imbued with a sense of sanctity, of life as a holy gift to be celebrated, than any other I have met. But most vividly of all, I think of a simple plot of sand and rocks and moss in Kyoto, the rock garden at Ryoanji Temple. The guidebooks will tell you that the rock garden was built in the 15th century, probably by a renowned Zen-influenced artist named Soami, and that it is considered a masterpiece of the Kare Sansui, dry landscape, garden style. It consists of 15 irregularly shaped rocks of varying sizes, some surrounded by moss, arranged in a bed of white sand that is raked every day. A low earthen wall surrounds the garden on three sides, overhung by a narrow beamed wooden roof. On the fourth side, wooden steps lead to a wide wooden platform and the main building of the temple itself. Beyond the wall are cedar, pine, and cherry trees. Such a description gives a sense of the history and look of the place, but to understand its power, its pure presence, you have to go there. The first time I visited Ryoanji, I was overwhelmed, first by the spareness of the site, and second by loudspeakers that every 15 minutes squawked out a recorded message about the history and spirit of the garden to the busloads of obedient school children and tourists who filed through. But something held me there. Morning passed to afternoon, and still I sat on the well-worn platform, staring. Kids in black caps, tiny book-filled backpacks, and black and white school uniforms passed by, studying me while I studied the garden. And adults in shiny cameras and kimonos clicked and clucked and walked on. Clouds came and went, and the branches beyond the garden bent, straightened, bent again. I saw how the pebbly sand had been meticulously raked in circles around the rocks and in straight lines in the open areas, and how those lines stopped without a misplaced pebble when they touched the circular patterns and then resumed unchanged beyond them. I saw how pockets of moss had filled the pox in the stones, and how the sand echoed the sky, the moss echoed the trees, the wall and roof balanced the platform, and the rocks seemed to emanate a web of intricate, tranquil tension within the whole. It was an exquisite enigma, telling me something I couldn't put words to, and so it has remained. I have seen Ryoanji in spring when the cherry trees bloomed, and in fall when their branches were bare, in winter when snow covered the moss, and in summer when the cicadas buzzed beyond the wall. I have been there among giggling teenagers and gaping farmers, bemused Westerners and beatific monks. By now it has become a part of me, and still it eludes me. I love the place partly because it is so emphatically not a 10-minute tourist stop. Its dimensions defy the camera. I've never seen a true picture of the place, and its subtle simplicity defies quick assimilation. It makes you sit and study, slow down and stare until you really see it in its particularity and in its whole simultaneously. And yet, and here the enigma expands, you cannot see all of Ryoanji at one time. The rocks are so arranged that you can see only 14 of the stones wherever you stand. You have to visualize, imagine the other one. How wonderful. It is in this sense that Ryoanji is, for me, the essential sacred place. It is complete in itself, but for you to completely perceive it, you have to transcend the boundary between inner and outer, to travel inward as well as outward, to find and finish it in your mind. And the gigglers, the camera clickers, and the squawking loudspeakers are all, in their exasperating reality, part of this completion. Beyond a great irony of modern Japan, loudspeakers instructing you to appreciate the silence, they embody a much larger meaning. You must embrace them all, the monks and the moss and the trees, the school kids and the stones, to really be there, to be whole. Thank you. I would love to answer any questions you might have about travel, writing, the world,
great.
Life.
I'd like to remind the audience that they're listening to Don George speaking about his book, The Ways of the Wanderlust. It's time for questions and answers.
Yes, sir. Could you recommend any particular videos or movies or TV shows to us would-be travelers? You know, Lawrence of Arabia, Scott of the Antarctic, and Rick Steves come to mind.
Right? yes, Midnight in Paris, The English Patient. There's an Antonioni film called, I think it's called Profession Reporter, Profession Reporter. That's one of the most magical, amazing movies I've ever seen. Yeah, those all come to my mind immediately as very transporting movies that will take you out of wherever you are and put you in a very wonderful setting.
I was wondering what you felt in comparing traveling by yourself to compare to traveling with one or more people.
Yeah, that's a great question. I find that as a writer, I get my best stories when I travel by myself, generally. When you're alone, you're vulnerable, you're open to the world, people come up to you and talk to you, they take care of you. When you're with someone else or with multiple people, there's a sense that you have your own group and you don't need any help. So in that sense, I find as a writer, traveling alone very exciting and gives me the best stories, and I always get into more trouble when I travel alone. And that always makes for good stories. I do love traveling with groups too, and I actually have begun very recently, in the past couple of years, I've actually begun leading tours as a lecturer, as an expert. And so I understand the value of those tours also. I mean, I think that they enable you to do things that you couldn't do individually. They give you access to expertise and special experiences that you might not be able to have. So I understand that side of that as well. I have to say that as a writer, I just love getting out there in the world on my own and having the world take care of me in its own way. I love arriving in a place and kind of being vulnerable and saying, here I am, you know, do with me what you will. I'm open. I want to absorb you. So take me. And I love that feeling of surrendering to a place and seeing where it takes you when you do that. That's always been really magical and pretty much always resulted in good things for me. One other person? Well, so I travel a lot with my wife, and I love traveling with my wife. It's a very different kind of an experience, but in some ways it's wonderful because it deepens and broadens your understanding of each other and of each other's world. We actually just came back from Burning Man, which is an entirely different planet. And it was, I think, wonderful for us to experience that together. And it would have been very difficult for me to experience that alone and then bring it back home with me and try to explain what had just happened. So that was a great thing to do as a couple. And I've traveled with my family. I have two kids who are now grown. But one of the most amazing trips I've ever been on was a family trip to the Galapagos that I think changed all of our lives. And the kids were in their teens. And it was a perfect place to take them at that age. That just, it opened up another alternate universe for them, the way the species coexisted, the way humans were guests in that place. It was not our place. It was the animals' place. It was the wildlife's place, and we were just visitors there. Reversing roles in that way was really great for them. And my daughter, who's now a marine biologist, says that she became a marine biologist because of that afternoon she spent swimming with the sea lions in the Galapagos, and that kind of introduced her to the wonder of the underwater world, and it changed her life.
Hi, I'm. Hello. I'm an educator, and before I was an educator, I did a lot of teaching abroad in similar programs that you have. But as a out of college, out of grad student, are there any opportunities out there to travel and teach, maybe in other parts of the world?
Absolutely, there are lots of teaching opportunities. There are still teaching opportunities in Japan, like what I did. There are lots of opportunities in Korea. I've heard that there are opportunities in Vietnam. I think almost any emerging country, there are opportunities to teach English. And I just was reminded today by a report on the radio that there's lots of Peace Corps opportunities as well. Lots and lots of older people now are applying to work in the Peace Corps, and they're using the expertise they've gained through their years of experience to really have a profound effect on other countries and cultures. So I think the world is full of opportunities, and you just the taking the leap of faith to go there or find them can be difficult. But I know people who've taught English all around the world who are still doing that, and it's an amazing experience, as you know, to live in a foreign place. Just broadens your mind and your worldview so hugely. And I think it's great that there are still opportunities for people, not just necessarily immediate college graduates, but people who are much older and have richer life experience. There are lots of opportunities for them.
So as the world changes in terms of geopolitics and climate change and other factors, what's a destination or destinations that you've been to that you would recommend going to sooner than later before their character or their essence is lost?
Well, the world certainly is changing, and I suppose Cuba comes immediately to mind as a place that's changing really rapidly. Myanmar is certainly changing rapidly. One of the things I find very instructive is I went to Bali about 3 years ago. And when I saw people, they said to me, oh, you know, you should have been here 40 years ago. And I said, actually, I was here 40 years ago. And when I arrived 40 years ago, people said to me, you should have been here 40 years ago. So a place like Bali and most of the really great places in the world have a real resilience, I think. And they have a core of richness and cultural value and belief that takes things in and embraces them and moves on. And so I think that even a place like Cuba, let's say, it will certainly be different next year and the year after and the year after and the year after. There will still be something wonderful about the Cuba that you discover whenever you get there. There will still be something quintessentially Cuban about it. And so while on the one hand, I understand very much why people say, I want to see it now before it changes. On the other hand, change is inevitable. Change is what our universe is all about. And the fact that something's changed doesn't make it less rich or more rich. It's just different. So I think that Cuba will always be there. And if you can't get there this year, then get there 5 years from now. And there will be wonders and mysteries awaiting you, just as there were in Bali 3 years ago. It wasn't the same wonders and mysteries, but they were wonderful and mysterious. And I had the most amazing trip again to Bali 3 years ago, as I did 40 years ago. So I think these places are resilient, and they reward you whenever you go.
That was one of the themes of Midnight in Paris by Woody Allen.
Absolutely.
It's always another generation that you look back on, right, are nostalgic for.
Oh, I wish I'd been there then.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Oh, I wish. Yeah.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Other question?
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about your writing process? Obviously, you went to Burning Man, and I don't know if the story has emerged or if it takes a while to recognize what the story is after the fact. Anyway, any part of that?
Yeah, thank you. Well, right now, the Burning Man story is a painful open wound right now that I'm working on. And I've been doing this for 40 years, and I would think that it would get easier after a while. It's supposed to get easier, but somehow writing does not seem to get easier. I'm struggling very much with the Burning Man story. But it's a fun, it's one of those love-hate kind of things. I love the process of struggling with the story and trying to figure it out. And what's the shape? What do I want to say? What does a reader need to know? All these questions. I love the writing process, and I've found that I appreciate something so much more deeply when I go through that writing process. I'll go somewhere, I'll have an amazing trip, I'll come back, and the fact that I need to think about it and write about it for someone who didn't have that amazing trip really makes me plunge much more deeply into the trip and what made it amazing. And I found that I usually ask myself when I get back from a trip, what did you learn? What did that place teach you? What did that experience teach you? And if I can isolate the main lessons that I learned, and then I can isolate the path that I followed to learn them, that becomes sort of the skeletal outline of my of my story. The problem with Burning Man is that there were so many lessons on so many layers that I feel like I've got about five stories all working at the same time, and trying to condense those and figure out what the real story that I need to tell is quite a challenge. But I do love that process very much. I try to set a period of time every day or every other day to write, to make sure that I get down 1,000 words a day, let's say. I always write in my journals very copiously when I'm on the road, and I find that oftentimes what I've written in my journal, I can pretty much take and transpose right into my article, and that really helps a lot. But it's still an effort. It's still a lot of work that I would not change for anything else. I love it. I hate it. I love it.
So it's obvious you come down on the experience versus reading approach to education. You said that's what you did right after when you made your choice. It'll start like the nature-nurture debate, but obviously it's a little useful for all of it. But your bottom line is exactly the same, education, to learn to something about what's going on. And everybody doesn't travel for that purpose. Everyone doesn't go to college for that purpose.
That's right. That's right. I find that places have secret lessons to teach you, and it's really, for me, a very fun thing to do when I come back and say, what did you learn? And that really helps crystallize what the experience was all about. Oh, Cambodia taught me this. Oh, how did I learn that? Oh, yeah, I met that person and I had that experience. I went to that temple. And suddenly a whole pathway emerges. And you're like, oh, I see.
So can you talk just a little bit about what you do to prepare to go to a place?
Yes, and I'll talk about what you should do to prepare to go to a place, and then what I do to prepare to go to a place. What you should do, I think, and what I say, I wrote a book about travel writing called Lonely Planet's Guide to Travel Writing, and I still believe what I wrote in that book, which is that you should have an idea where you want to go when you're going somewhere and why you want to go there. You have kind of a skeletal idea of an itinerary, and have a sense of this is why I'm going, this is what I want to do, and then be absolutely open to changing that completely when you get on the ground, because you'll meet the innkeeper the innkeeper will say, where are you going tomorrow? And you'll say, I'm going to that festival over the hill. And they'll say, oh, that's actually very touristy. There's another really local festival that's over there that you should go to instead, and suddenly you're going there instead, and that's wonderful. But you liberate yourself, I think, as a traveler if you have a skeletal sense of what you want to do. You enable the serendipities that will grace you on the road. So I think it's really important to read a lot about a place before you go there, to know some fundamental phrases, and to know the do's and don'ts, the things that you shouldn't do, the things that are okay to do, the major sort of cultural beliefs. I think it's great to know all that. Do I do that when I go somewhere? No, not necessarily. I find myself often, way too often these days, on the plane opening the guidebook thinking, so what am I doing again? But it all works out. And I do think that the more preparation you do, the richer your experience will be. I think probably as a lifetime traveler, I've learned to condense my preparation time and still manage to get a lot out of it. But there's no question that you'll have a richer experience if you know a lot about the place before you go there.
Questions?
Two things. How do you select the place you go? And as I look, the two place books that I really think of with travel is On the Road and The Adventures of Marco Polo. Uh-huh. And it seems to me that you go to places and you stay there. But what about the places, the voyage?
The voyage?
Well, traveling as a voyage rather than as a static experience.
Yeah, right, right. So I think that the voyage is important for me, and most of the stories in this book are based on voyages, not staying in a place so much as almost like parachuting into a place and trying to get the essence of it in a few days or a week or 2 weeks and then getting out. And I think that's the quintessential, that's what travel is all about. And certainly On the Road and Marco Polo, I mean, those are amazing accounts of wonders outside and inside. Trying to remember what the first part of your question was, though.
Well, how do you select the places?
How do I select the places? Right, thank you. I've been really lucky most of my life to be my own editor, so I've been able to walk into my office and tell myself I really wanted to go to Paris, and myself would say, that's an excellent idea. We really need someone to go to Paris, and you're just the man for it. So most of my life, I've been really lucky to do that. When I'm working with editors, there's a place that begins to intrigue me. Cambodia, for example. I had seen a picture of Angkor Wat a long, long time ago when I was a child, and it had stayed with me as one of the marvels of the world that I really, really wanted to get to see before I died. And I hadn't ever gotten there. And I was giving a speech in Singapore, and I realized that Cambodia was just a very short trip from Singapore. And I talked to an editor at BBC Travel and ended up being able to go to Cambodia for them because it had been this lifelong passion for me, and I didn't know what awaited me. I just had the feeling that something special was waiting for me there. I just had to find out what it was. And they were willing to sort of take a risk with me on that story, and that worked out. But when I was the travel editor at the Chronicle Examiner, I used to try to think about what do readers want to know and what do I want to know and what's the marriage, what's the happy place where those meet. And that was always fun because, as you know, the San Francisco audience is the best audience in the world. Incredibly wonderful, smart, intelligent, well-traveled, sophisticated people who have a great sense of the world and its possibilities. So I pretty much was able to go almost anywhere I wanted to go when I was at the Examiner, and found that it resonated with readers when I wrote personally about how a place had affected me, that really people responded to that.
We've spoken about lots of exotic places, Cambodia and Paris, Antarctica and so forth. Can you comment on travel opportunities in those places very nearby, Canada and Mexico?
Yes, I actually was just in Mexico, had a wonderful time in Cancun, of all places. But had a spectacular time, actually at a Club Med, of all places. And the reason why we were there was that my daughter just got married. And before she got married, we decided as a family of four, we would do something. We'd take a sentimental journey. And when they were very young, we used to go to Club Meds quite a bit. And so my adult two children and my wife and I went to the Club Med and actually had a spectacular time reliving old memories and making new memories and kind of a very sentimental, poignant family journey. But Mexico is certainly fantastic. So many Teotihuacan, there's so many great places to go there, and it's not that expensive and it's easy to get to for us. So I've always found that Mexico is a fantastic destination. Vancouver is one of my favorite cities on the planet. It's a lot like San Francisco, but with a Canadian twist. And I find that Toronto and Montreal have very vibrant, rich cultural scenes, drama. They're both really fantastic. And you don't have to, obviously, it's a lot easier to get there. So I'm always happy when I meet people who say they're going to Mexico or Canada because it makes a lot of sense to get to know our neighbors also. I love them. And the same thing for New England, too, which is even less of a foreign country. But I love going back to New England. There's a lot of richness there that I didn't understand when I was young because it was natural. And I assumed the whole world was like this. But having been away for some decades, if you go back, I see, there's a very special spirit here and some very special attractions here, too.
A lot of travelers say that there's the top 10 list in the world you have to see and all that kind of thing. Which of the top 10, sort of ancient wonders of the world were disappointing, and which ones you said that really deserves its place? Did you ever come across one that was then somehow disappointing because it had been surrounded by too much touristy stuff or whatever?
Well, I will have to say that actually Angkor Wat was kind of disappointing. I think partly because I'd built it up so hugely from my 5-year-old memory, but mostly because there were so many tourists there. And it's incredibly ironic for a travel writer to say there were too many tourists there. And I do, anyway, I think everybody should go to Angkor Wat. There's absolutely, my life is much richer because I went there. I'm so happy that I did, and I tried to go there early in the morning and late at night and to sort of minimize how many other people I would be sharing it with, but there were still lots and lots of people there. And it did, what detracted especially from the experience was the age of the selfie stick and the kind of people posing dramatically in doorways and taking photos of themselves. And seeming to be absolutely oblivious to the meaning and significance of the place they were using as a photo backdrop. And that was distressing to me. Here's a very, very sacred place that was built hundreds and hundreds of years ago that a lot of people have invested a lot of time and energy and emotion into. And to make that the backdrop for your selfie that you're going to post on your Facebook page, I found sad. But then that inspired, I was happy that I went there anyway, and then that inspired me to go further afield, and I ended up having some incredible experiences at these jungle temples that nobody was at except me, that I found because Angkor Wat kind of inspired me to get off the beaten path, and that was really remarkable and amazing. And I write about that in the last story in this book, is about going into those jungle temples.
I think about this experience just in a particular way. It reminds me of Ronald Reagan talking over talking class, right, directly to other people. And it seems to me that these monuments that were created by people to express this in Kyoto and all those places, they talk right over the crowds to the people who want to hear it.
Right.
And so although it's no different than the jungle being around it, it's other things all around it, but people are communicating, just like through books with ideas that come down for thousands of years.
Right.
They found a way to communicate to the future.
Right. I absolutely agree. That's wonderful. I felt that. I remember feeling that in Notre Dame when I walked in, and what I felt more strongly than anything else in Notre Dame was the fact it was the accumulation of reverence and faith and sacrifice that just hung in the air there. It just was palpable. You felt it, that for centuries people had been coming here investing their faith and their anguish and their hope and their yearning. It was heavy in the air, and I remember thinking, wow, this is what these sacred places are all about. It's what people invest them with. It was, yeah.
Can you talk about any challenges you may have had that were due primarily to being a Westerner, and even more specifically to being a Caucasian male while traveling in developing countries or any country at all?
Yes, I can't. There's a couple that come immediately to mind. One was just in Jamaica, where I was with my family, and we were generally having a very nice experience, but we went to one place where we'd been advised to go and take a river cruise on a kind of a platform of logs that had been put together. And for some reason, there was just a real feeling of racial divisiveness and unrest there. And my kids were really young at that time. And I remember getting on this structure and starting to be pulled down a river. And there was just a really restive feeling all around. And I just felt there's an explosive thing about to happen here. This isn't very good. And we actually ended up getting off the trip early and going back. And that just immediately came to mind because I don't very often have those experiences, almost never, as a matter of fact. And that one really sticks in my brain just because feeling uncomfortable like that is foreign to me. I usually feel pretty comfortable. And that was odd. I was feeling uncomfortable and I was aware of it and I was analyzing it. And I was like, what can I do to diffuse this situation? And I was clueless. I didn't know what to do to diffuse the situation. I felt like it had nothing to do with me, really. It was going back to lots of other things that were going on in the island at that time and before then. And so I just kind of went, okay, let's just remove ourselves from this. The other one that comes immediately to mind is when I was in Pakistan traveling in the early 80s, I think it was. The mid-80s. I was on a tour led by Geographic Expeditions. I was the travel editor at the Examiner at that time, but I took a GOX trip up the Karakoram Highway, up to Hunza, magical Hunza. And it was a wonderful trip, but it was extremely challenging for me because we were told on the first day, the one woman we met on the trip was a public relations person for the big Western-style hotel we were staying at. And we were told by her and by others on the first day that we could not encounter any other women on the trip. We were not to speak to them. We were not to photograph them. We were not in any way to interact with them because that would cause huge problems. And so I immediately felt myself cut off from a half of the population. And it was very hard for me as a journalist, as a writer, as a human being, as a traveler, to go through a country trying to understand its essence and write about its essence and not have access to half of the population. It was a really, really odd, disturbing feeling. And I remember writing about it in my journal, like, this is almost impossible to get a sense for this country without being able to talk to all of the women. And that was just very, it was unsettling. It was weird to not be able to talk. And you had this sense of, oh, I might make a mistake. I might glance at a woman and cause an international incident. I'd better keep my blinders on. And that was very uncomfortable. Those are the two that come to mind.
Great question. So we have time for one more question.
Have you been to Madagascar? And if you have, what do you think about it?
It's going to be a very short answer to that question, unfortunately. I have not been to Madagascar. I have heard about Madagascar, that it's got an amazing variety of wildlife, and it's kind of like a little bit of the Galapagos in Africa, sort of. So I've heard great things about it, and I'd like to go there. But I have not been there yet.
I think Sorry that's an amazing, say. Amazing final question that you probably found the one country in the whole world that he hasn't gone to. No, that's great. That's great. Well, it gives you something to go to.
Exactly. It's on my list.
Well, thank you very much, Don. That was excellent.
Thank you.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 115th year of enlightened discussion.